He was the driver, the navigator, the publicist, the security guard, the caterer, the accountant, and the valet. He did so much for me that it was embarrassing. I've never shat on a person once, even when I felt they deserved to be shat on. But Nate chewed out club owners, promoters on my behalf, like I was Mariah Carey or something. Eventually, I had to speak up. Nate, people keep coming over and saying that my tour manager's an asshole. He said, Kev, listen to me, man. I get shit done. Don't ask how I do it, but I always do it. You know what I'm saying? Like, if I ain't gonna do what I had to do to get the shit done, the shit wouldn't be done. But you don't want to know how I get it done. And as long as they mad at me and not mad at you, then that's how I get it done. You understand what I'm saying? You see what I'm saying? I said, listen to me. I don't want them to be mad at anybody. You're a reflection of me, Nate. We would get into it all the time. But I appreciated where his heart was at. So I stuck with him. And I kept reminding him not to be a dick to people. Then on March 22nd, 2005, it happened. I stood in the delivery room and I watched the doctors guide my daughter into the world. As soon as I saw her, tears ran down my face. I couldn't remember the last time I cried. The little boy who spent half his childhood in a fort made of bedding in Mrs. Davis's basement was now a father. This beautiful baby was mine to love, nurture, and raise. To succeed, all I had to do was not do anything my father had done. I wanted our daughter to have a name similar to Kevin. So I told Tori we should name her Kavina, you know, which, by the way, is totally valid, okay? It's a valid woman's name. It's a female form of Kevin, in the same way that Roberta is a female form of Robert. But Tori wisely slammed the door shut on that dream. Instead, she came up with the best name I could ever imagine for a daughter. Altogether, Heavenly Heart. It was a happy day for us. While Tori and Heaven were recuperating in the hospital, the nurse asked if I had a car seat for the ride home. I had no experience with babies, so I didn't know that this was a legal requirement. I immediately drove to Target and spent probably 2 hours reading each box, asking employees questions, selecting what I thought was the safest seat, and then struggling to install it. You want to know what Heaven is like? It's like putting Heaven in that car seat for the first time, making sure the padding and straps are set just right to protect her tiny body, and knowing that we're taking her home to be a part of our lives forever. It was my first daddy task, and I took it seriously. I took it as serious as her life. Tori was in a wheelchair, so I helped her get in the car as well. Before I slid in the driver's seat, I looked at Tori sitting in the front and Heaven in the back, and suddenly I didn't feel trapped in a crazy relationship anymore. I felt privileged to be a part of a family. When we got home, there was no fighting. It was all about taking care of my two girls. The fact that such an angry time in our lives had produced such a sweet, gentle, beautiful soul seemed like a miracle. Every time I saw Heaven in those first weeks, I told myself, I need to make this work for her. Chapter 67. Using my goddamn brain. For a month, my relationship with Tori felt miraculously normal. We woke up together, usually to the sound of Heaven. We ate our meals together, watched television together, went out together. Took turns each night putting Heaven back to sleep when she woke up crying. We were a team. But there was one thing missing from this team. Someone had to go to work and earn money. I still had a mission, but it was one now I needed to balance with this new responsibility of being a father. As soon as I told Tori that I was going away to perform, we fell right back into our old pattern. Who you going to go fuck? What are you talking about? Terrence booked me on some spots. Are you serious right now? Whatever. Probably got a bitch waiting for you right now. What am I supposed to do? Someone's got to stay with the baby, Tori. All right, so what? You get to do whatever you want while I'm just stuck here? We don't have a choice. If I don't work, we can't feed the baby. Okay, you go work. Just don't get that bitch pregnant. Jesus Christ. I had a lot of shows lining up. Terrence was such a talker that he sold me to bookers who never heard my name before. His argument was the same every time. Now, you may not know this guy here, but he's the next big thing. And I was the next big thing. For years, as Nate and I went back and forth, side to side, around the country, hitting up the small clubs that Glenn wouldn't touch. Outside of carving a couple of days from each week to spend time with Heaven, I didn't say no to stage time. I ended up doing every college you'd ever heard of and every shit comedy club that you wouldn't take a date to. At first, the goal was to get back to the craft and be productive. But eventually, I noticed that there were people at shows who knew me. Mostly from Soul Plane, sometimes from Scary Movie 3, even occasionally from Paper Soldiers. Those movies had come and gone, but each one had captured a few fans that I recognized was more valuable than a holding deal, because a true fan pays dividends for life. So, if at every show I could pick up a few more fans, then leaving Hollywood to tour might turn out to be the best possible thing I could do for my film career. I could overcome the stigma of being a proven failure by becoming too popular for the entertainment business to deny. I needed to build myself a following so big that instead of worrying that saying yes to me or one of my projects was a mistake, the gatekeepers would worry about saying no. They would worry that that would be a mistake. At the time, Dane Cook was one of the most popular comedians in the country. I met him at the Improv one night and asked him how he'd grown his audience. His answer was, by getting email addresses, using social media of that era, like MySpace, and having the patience to stay engaged in the lives of his fans. See, when you have somebody who's created a blueprint that's working, all you gotta do is copy it. So Nate and I went to a copy shop and had 3x5 cards printed. As I ended each set, he passed them out and asked people to fill out their contact information. Email, street address, phone, social site, everything. Then he'd add each person's name to a database for that city. The next time I came through town, we'd hit up everyone on that email. On MySpace, by phone, everything short of knocking on the door. Before the show, Nate, Naeem, when I could get him an opening spot, and I, we would all go to malls, barbershops, and shopping streets, all just to hand out flyers. After each show, I'd treat the audience just like customers of City Sports. I spent some time talking with them about their life and making sure to remember their name and story if they came to another show. Sometime I'd even exchange phone numbers with them so I could reach out in a more personal way next time I was in town. Afterward, I start seeing them in the audience all the time, some of them still to this day. My new business manager had worked out a payment plan with the IRS, and I needed to make more money at the shows. So Nate and I set up a merchandise table at each club. We couldn't afford actual merchandise like t-shirts, so instead we bought a Polaroid camera. After each show, Nate would stand there with the camera and talk audience members into paying $20 to take a photo with me, which I then personalized and signed. Desperation is the best motivator there is. If I hadn't sunk so low, I wouldn't have been willing to work so hard. But I was happy busting my ass on the road, because we were creating a business that was completely ours. Chapter 68. The many faces of Kevin Hart, all of which are looking at each other confused. Here's a life lesson. If you're having problems in your relationship, getting married or having children is not going to solve them. It's just going to create new problems. This may be common sense to most intelligent human beings, but it wasn't to me. So I continued to learn the hard way. Tori's and my endless argument about my work took on a new dimension. Now she resented me for leaving her with Heaven and making the baby her sole responsibility. And I resented her because she didn't seem to understand that parenting isn't just about being physically present with the child. It's about also providing for a child. Food, clothing, shelter, education, opportunities. I thought about how hard my mom had worked to provide for me. She wasn't present all the time, but she was the most caring mother I could imagine. Almost every time I left for a show, and every time I returned, there was an argument. And one night, as my parenting, my career, and my mother were all being attacked, I ran out of patience. Do I have so little self-respect that I'm allowing someone to talk to me like this? Instead of leaving, like a man who actually had self-respect would do, I began yelling back at her. Between the two of us that night, hairbrushes were thrown, mirrors were broken, and our television set was smashed. Heaven somehow slept through this, thanks to either the white noise machine in her room or the fact that she was so used to it by now that it sounded like white noise. Our neighbors, however, called the cops on us again, and soon there was a loud knocking on the front door. I opened it as calmly as I could and saw the two cops standing there. Officers were fine, it's no big deal. They looked around the house, saw the mess, no. One of the officers said, we need to separate you two. He seemed to know our situation. All of a sudden, I realized it was the same officer who had shown up when Tori and I were fighting during the pregnancy. He looked at me like I was a piece of shit, which is exactly what I was. The kind of guy who's always got cops in the living room from breaking up domestic disputes is trash. We're taking you in, the officer said. When I was released the next day, I moved back into my old apartment where JT was living. After a few days, I visited heaven and I ended up staying with Tori again for a week. I went back and forth between the apartments, wrestling with myself. Single Kevin. We're always fighting. We're always going at each other. One of us is going to end up in prison for real one of these days. Our shit's still not right, and it's never going to be right. Fuck this. I'm out of here. Now, relationship, Kevin. He said, how can I be so selfish? You know, I'm not only walking out on my wife, but I'm walking out on my daughter. There's a name for people who do this. It's called deadbeat dads. I can't be a deadbeat dad. I don't want my daughter to come from a broken home. I'm going back. Single Kevin said, nope, this is worse than before. We're not united as parents. We're not happy together. It's fine for us to destroy our lives, but we can't destroy the life of this innocent child. I'm out. Relationship Kevin was like, why did I leave in the first place? I can deal with any heckler in the crowd, but I can't handle my own wife. Put yourself in her shoes. She left her job, came to L.A. because I invited her. Now she's here. She's got no family, no job, and she's trapped with my child. How can I be so damn selfish? I need to go back to that poor woman and apologize. Single Kevin came right back. Nah, man. I just want to be happy. Relationship Kevin, cut him off. No, I'm not. I'm not going to be happy if I'm fucked up father who abandoned his family. The single Kevin chimed in. I'm going. Relationship Kevin cut him off. I'm staying. Both Kevins at the same time simply said, fuck. Fuck. Couldn't make a decision. It was a relationship ping pong. I was in, I was out, I was there, I was gone. I felt good, I felt bad. I loved Tori, I hated Tori. I loved God, God hated me. In the end, the same tenacity that enabled me to take so many whoopings from Hollywood and keep coming back for more also kept me coming back to Tori, hoping that if I worked harder, that things would go differently. Chapter 69. My 18th lucky break. One day I got lucky. Cat Williams had gotten a role in an action movie called Fool's Gold, which was shooting in Australia. But he got in trouble with the law and wasn't allowed to leave the country. The casting agents called Dave and said they needed the comedian as soon as possible to play the villain in a film named Big Bunny. Dave mentioned my name and they asked him to send an audition tape. Instead, Dave insisted that they meet me in person. It was the first big role that I'd been up for in a while, but I had no experience playing James Bond-style supervillains. I was desperate to get the part. So I went to a pet store, I bought a Big Bunny, and I took it to the audition. I did the entire Big Bunny scene sitting in the chair stroking a rabbit. It was a gamble, but the casting agents loved the courage it took and ended up giving me the part. The writers even incorporated the bunny into the script. It was more proof that only your mother thinks you're special. To all other people, you look the same as everyone else until you make the effort to stand out. And the effort is always worth it. I kept the bunny and I took it home as a reminder of this lesson. Fool's Gold was a $70 million tropical action movie starring Matthew McConaughey and Kate Hudson. When I arrived in Australia, the producers gave me a rental car, keys to an apartment, and a sheet with call times. They then informed me that the people drive on the opposite side of the road in Australia. But because I wasn't a star, the rest was up to me. To be professional, show up on time, kill the material, and make the director, who was Andy Tennant, make him feel like I had a future in this business. I've been given another shot. Being so far away from home for 3 months, I'm not going to lie, I miss my family. Even Tori. So she came out with heaven. And in the paradise of coastal Queensland, Australia, she told me that she had bad news. My bunny rabbit, my lucky reminder to always be different, was dead. She killed little Big Bunny. And though she said she didn't know how it happened, I figured that they'd probably gotten into an argument because he was tired of eating carrots at home and wanted to go outside and hunt for wild carrots. Outside of that, though, we got along the whole time. I mean, I felt like things were turning around. My movie career was starting up again. Tori and I weren't fighting. Heaven was growing into a beautiful girl. And Naeem, who was house-sitting for us, he decided to move to Los Angeles permanently. Then my brother called in a panic. Chapter 70. There are no words to summarize this one. Look, man. Mom told me not to tell you this. When he said that, I just braced myself for something painful. He goes, Mom is sick. I could feel myself getting ill as I heard the words. I said, how sick? He He said, real sick. She didn't want you to find out because she knows that this movie is big for you and that you wouldn't have done it if you had known how bad it was. I said, how bad is that? He said, as bad as a death sentence, man. If you don't come home soon, the next time you probably see mom's gonna be in the grave. And I'm sorry for telling you so late, but look, if you're mad, you just gotta deal with it, because those were her wishes. I felt like the world stopped spinning. I drifted in and out as he continued. Ovarian cancer, a year ago. I only found out by accident. Family, when? Kev. I said, dude, I'll be on the next plane home. As I hung up, I explained the situation to the producers. Fortunately, Big Bunny wasn't in a lot of scenes that week, so they were able to adjust the schedule and let me go home for a few days. My brother picked me up at the airport, told me that mom was refusing to get the treatment. She believed in God's will, he reported. And if God wanted her to get healthy, then she'd get better. And if God wanted to take her in the same way her own mother had died of ovarian cancer, then she'd get sicker. I'll let God handle it. That's what she kept telling my brother. I felt all my childhood frustration rise to the surface as he went on about my mom's stubbornness. If God really wanted to handle those things himself, without human participation, then he wouldn't have created doctors. Kenneth pulled into the driveway of my mom's house and ran inside. My heart broke when I saw her. She was sitting in an armchair, and her stomach was so swollen that she looked pregnant. She was in a lot of pain and wasn't even able to go to the bathroom. I didn't want you to know, she said softly. It's wonderful that you're out here doing your thing, my little Kevin, but just know that you've made me so happy. Tears instantly filled my eyes. I asked her if she could please go to the hospital, not for herself, but for me and Kenneth. This way so we would know that we'd done all that we could. And thankfully, my mom agreed. We took her to Temple University Hospital, the same place that my brother and I were born, and she began chemotherapy. While she was unhappy there, she built her life around working hard, being around loved ones, and participating in church community. Here, everything seemed cold and clinical and far from God. You weren't seen as a soul on your way to paradise, just as a chart on the clipboard. These people don't want me here, she insisted. Take me home. With the money from Fool's Gold, I was able to set her up at home with a hospital bed, around-the-clock nursing. When possible, we had a doctor come in and do treatments at her bedside. The day I was flying back to Australia, my brother called. He said, you gotta come back over the house. I said, why? He said, there's a bird in the basement. Huh? He said, you heard me. There's a bird in the basement, Kevin. Oh, shit. I'd be right there. See, when we were young, my mom had filled our head with dozens of superstitions. One was about splitting a pole being bad luck. Another was that if a bird flies into the house, it was a sign of death. When I arrived at the house, I asked for clarification. I said, all right, look, if a bird gets into the house, but you catch it and take it outside, does that mean that you got the death out of the house too? My cousin Cheryl said, well, if you can get the bird, evidently they all tried. If that's all it takes, then we'll go get that bird right now. We're going to get his ass out of this house and my mom will be okay. Kenneth and I went downstairs. The bird was huge. I mean, it really looked like death. My brother was armed with a mop. I had a broom. The plan was to swat and chase the beast out the basement. Kenneth swung the mop at it, swooped in my direction. I dropped the broom. I went running up the steps so fast I fell at the top. However, a true hero never gives up. I bravely picked up the phone and called the Society of the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals to come and get the goddamn bird. I mean, that still counts, right? I asked Cheryl afterwards, not long after I returned to Australia, I was speaking to my dad on the phone, and he told me he'd gotten what they call a pap something. I found out later that he had lung cancer. So where my mom didn't like getting treatment and kept saying, I'll leave it up to God, my dad wanted every treatment available, and he kept saying, God, why me? I was able to take a few more days off, so I flew back to Philadelphia to visit my folks. I was worried I was going to lose both of them until I spoke to my father's doctor, who explained to my relief that even though Dad was talking like he was going to die any day, he was going to pull through this just fine. Now, my mom, however, was back in the hospital because the cancer had progressed. No one mentioned it, but we all knew what was going to happen. I sat with her each day, happy to be near her. Every time I left her bedside, I made sure to tell her that I loved her. They were hitting her hard with the chemo. and she was having relatively good days and really bad days. On a good day, my brother and I got the most loving version of my mom there was. On a bad day, we were verbal punching bags for whatever she was angry about at the moment. One afternoon, after Kenneth gave her some water, she said he was the greatest son in the world. Showered him with all the praises she'd never given him growing up. It filled his soul with exactly what it had needed all these years. The next day he was given a word again, and she choked on it. Instantly, he became purse-snatching Kenneth again. You trying to kill me. I know what you up to, boy. You want to murder me so you can get that insurance money. My mom began insisting that we stop the treatments, take her back home, and let God get on with his work. There was no convincing her otherwise. Dad even visited her. Tried to tell her that his God wanted her to do chemo, and then he ended up in an argument with her that seemed just like the old days. On my last day in Philadelphia, Kenneth and I sat with my mom for hours. He was on one side of a chair, I was on the other side. While she was speaking, Kenneth dozed off from exhaustion. Suddenly my mom summoned strength from God knows where to reach out. She smacked him across the face. You better wake up. That's what she said. These could be the last words I ever speak, and you didn't hear falling asleep. After I returned to Australia, I got the call from Kenneth that mom was no longer in pain. She was in a better place. I instantly said a prayer from me to her, just thanking her for her love, letting her know that I was in a great position in life because of the lessons that she taught me, and promising to continue honoring her by keeping her wisdom, compassion, and leadership alive in me. The producers allowed me to go back to Philadelphia one more time to make arrangements for the funeral and bury my mom, my rock, my teacher. I never lost a loved one before, but I noticed that I processed it differently than everyone else in my family. I knew that my mom had wanted to stop suffering, and her wish had been granted. It was only us, those left behind who were still suffering. And we had just two choices, to stop living or to go on living. It was strange to travel back to Australia after the funeral and see that nothing had changed. Airport security still yelled about traveling with liquids. The plane still smelled like old carpet. Couples still kissed and bickered and ignored each other. The sky was still blue. The movie crew was still scurrying around, coordinating the same tiny details through their radios. Everything was different for me, but in the world, everything was the same. When you mourn, when you hurt, when someone you love or everyone you love passes, it may feel like a void has opened up in your universe. But in the universe, energy can never be destroyed. So if the pain and the absence existed only in my mind, then it wasn't real. It was imaginary, and being hurt or angry about it wasn't going to change anything. There was nothing I could do except let go of the tragic story, embrace the one that served me and her better. So I did. I chose not to lose my mom, and instead to gain an angel. And in my mind, my heart, and my life, she is still completely present to this day, and as wise and compassionate and stubborn as ever. Life lessons from independence. Waiting for other people to make your dreams come true is like waiting for a bus on a corner where there's no bus stop. Sometimes the bus driver may feel bad for you and stop anyway, but usually he'll speed right past and leave you standing there like an idiot. Chapter 71. When life hands you shit sandwiches, just keep your mouth shut. Nobody wants to eat shit. Well, except those people in those weird pornos where they do that stuff with poop. Those people like shit. So that was for everybody except them. Those people. When someone dies in your family, traditionally there's a period of mourning. This is generally followed by a period of amazement. This period begins when you start going through the possessions of the deceased. Sometimes the amazement is positive. Oh my God. Look at Dad's Coke bottle collection. Yo, it's worth $1 million. Sometimes the amazement is negative. Oh my God. Dad's wanted by the FBI. And sometimes it's just confusing. Oh my God, why does Dad have 3 boxes full of pubic hair? What the fuck was he doing? In our case, we experienced all 3 kinds of amazement. The positive, Kenneth found the box of memorabilia from both of our careers. There were videotapes of the big house that my mom had recorded every week. Newspaper clippings from my appearance at Just for Laughs, advertisements for my performance at the Laugh House, any accolade I received. If my mom had access to it, she clipped and saved it. From Kenneth, she saved flyers announcing pool tournaments that he started and competed in, and even articles about the military drill accident that restarted their relationship. She never mentioned being aware of most of these things, yet it turned out that she followed our lives more closely than we thought. The negative. Kenneth found a lot of pictures of mom and dad in intimate situations that no child ever wanted to see. The confusing. We found a family tree that mom had made. On it, she'd written names of my dad's relatives, who I'd never met, as well as how they died. Peaches got stabbed at a block party, Booby got stabbed in jail, and I forgot where James got stabbed. But anyway, most of them were gone. The confusing part kicked in when we saw a list of seven names underneath my father's branch of the tree. Two of those names were Kevin and Robert, which is my brother's name, Robert Kenneth Hart. The rest were names of Dad's other kids. Some I knew about, others I didn't. But next to those seven names, my mom had written number 11 and circled it. It was a mystery. Neither of us could figure out what the number 11 meant, but it felt significant. The next time we spoke to Dad, Kenneth asked him about it. What does this number 11 mean? I don't understand it. Just leave it alone, boy. Nah, mom is gone. Somebody gotta keep this information alive. We need to know where the fuck we come from, man. Well, look, you're the oldest of the Roberts, okay? What the hell you mean, the Roberts? There are more Roberts than you. There's four of them that Nance knew about. But there may be five. Why would you do that, Dad? Why the fuck would you even think to do that? I wanted to name everybody Omar. Only one of them women would let me do it. When they didn't go for Omar, I tried Robert, because that's my dad's middle name. So you got five sons named Robert, Dad? You're fucking nuts, man. Suddenly we understood why my mom started calling my brother by his middle name. The name Robert had become a reminder of all my dad's affairs. My brother was the first of his children, but almost every other one was born while he and my mom were together. Meanwhile, Tori was pregnant again. Coming right after the loss of my mom, I felt like it was a sign to keep building the next generation of hearts. We gotta get a house. That's what I told Tori. That's what we need to be a family. A real home. That'll fix everything. With the money I had left from Fool's Gold, I rented a house on Lamona Avenue in Sherman Oaks for $4,500 a month. Instantly, the relationship changed. Instead of arguing in an apartment, we were now arguing in a house. Tori named our son Hendrix to do a run on the H's for our kids' names. And I got in Kevin as his middle name. Hendrix Kevin Hart. By trying to give the same name to all my kids, I guess I was more like my dad than I thought. Then the inevitable happened. I had to get back on the road. And that shit hit the fan. You're never here. I'ma find me a job. And you stay home with the baby. All you do is party with your friends. I left for the airport with the usual thoughts running through my head. Oh well. You know what? All I'm doing is I'm going to get served a big shit sandwich for taking off to do more shows, and then I'll eat it. But I'm not going to stop focusing on what I believe is going to change our lives and get us financially secure and give a good education to our kids. In New York, I had very little real-world experience to talk about on stage. But now I had the one thing that comes to all people with age. More baggage. I was trapped in an unhappy marriage with an angry wife, two beautiful children, and bills. Bills that I couldn't afford to pay. I had problems and a struggle that were relatable to many people, and I was living them out at a level so intense that I didn't need to exaggerate a thing. I didn't have a voice in my relationship, but I had a voice on stage. I could speak my mind, acknowledge the insanity of my situation, and be understood on such a raw, uncomfortable level that elicited knowing laughter. I was careful, though, never to humiliate or belittle Tori, but instead to make me, my reactions, my cowardice, my inability to be the man in the relationship, the butt of the jokes. All this set up a vicious cycle. The better I got at comedy, the more bookings I got. The more bookings I got, the worse things got at home. The worse things got at home, the better I got at comedy. Before long, my set was 45 minutes of solid material. I invited Dave to a show and he was blown away. "I think you're ready to do an hour-long special," he said. An hour-long special is the holy grail of stand-up. Do a tight 60 and you get to join the annals of giants. Richard Pryor's live in concert. George Carlin's jamming in New York. Eddie Murphy's delirious. Bill Hicks, Relentless, Chris Rock's Bring the Pain, Dave Chappelle's Killing Them Softly. I told Dave that I didn't want to have to pour my heart and soul into something, only to have some executive's assistants calling 2 days before it's supposed to air saying, we decided this isn't right for us, and we're going to own all the rights, so no one's ever going to see it. I wanted to own it. I wanted to control it. I wanted to do it myself. The only problem was that I couldn't actually afford to do it myself. So while Dave worked on finding someone to help me finance it, I kept touring and wrecking my marriage. Chapter 72. Remember when I said I had two hustles working for me? Well, that was a bad idea. I got hustled. What did I expect, really? While I was building my special, Terrence Locke cooked up a plan to make me and him better money. Now, I know you hate those package shows that Glenn has been putting you on. That's what he told me when we was backstage at another empty theater. Let's put together one that features you and has enough big names that it will sell out those theaters. You could do 20 dates in a month and walk away with $200,000. Easy. Terrence and Nate lined up 6 other comedians that they represented and knew. Each one of us stood to make 6 figures from the whole road show. Terrence said he had collected the guaranteed money up front so that nothing would go wrong. He was doing such a good job that I let Glenn go, and I went all the way in with Terrence and Nate. Just before the tour was supposed to start, we reached out to Terrence for my first check so that I could make my nut. And I learned that only a nut would trust Terrence Locke with this money. He didn't answer the phone that day, the next day, or the next year. No one could find him anywhere. This motherfucker had disappeared, along with the money that he supposedly collected. The tour fell apart, and everyone went their separate ways pissed off. I didn't see Terrence's face again for 8 years. When I did, I found out that he'd been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. He didn't say anything about the missing money, but I figured he hadn't been insured. If he had just told us, I'm sure most of us would have helped him. After Terrence disappeared, I found myself in a familiar situation. Home, car, and tax payments due. Nothing in my pockets, another box office failure, Fool's Gold launched and quickly sank even deeper than the buried treasures in the film. Critics destroyed the movie, most giving it 1 star. They called it stupid, tedious, and excruciatingly lame. I was out with Nate one night talking about ways to make more money, and he said, hey, look, I can do all that for you, you know? I'm a hard worker. I'll put the cash in your pocket, man. What exactly do you mean by that? I can make the calls on your behalf, book gigs for you. I can bring you dates. Just allow me to hustle for you, you know what I'm saying? Damn. This is one of those right or left moments. I could either make a decision based on what everyone else said about Nate, or I could trust a guy who had been tirelessly busting his ass for me. I decided to trust him. Okay, do your thing. Damn, Kev, I promise you won't regret it, man. Give me 6 months, and I'll get you double what you're making. Shit, I'm not shitting you, shit. Immediately, Nate started hustling. He had me doing bars, banquets, marching band rehearsals, even a pimpin' hoe convention. I don't know how he was finding half the shit, but I was paying my bills on time, and I was putting food on the table, so I didn't ask. But then I noticed that I'd walk into gigs, and everyone would be pissed at me. The promoter, the owner, the host, the waitstaff. They'd all be looking at me like I was a volcano that might erupt at any moment. It didn't take much time to get to the root of it. And the root of it, of course, was Nate. I heard him on the phone one afternoon getting aggressive with a club. Either I get the money tomorrow or there ain't gonna be no show, okay? Look, I don't give a shit. Fuck y'all. Fuck this whole damn thing. If Kevin Hart don't see that money, then Kevin Hart's not going to show up. And you can tell them people in that club of yours that the show is canceled and Kevin Hart ain't coming. Now, I'm sure that threats are an effective way of doing business for the mafia, but I don't want to be feared. I want to be enjoyed. That's why I got into the business in the first place. However, I wasn't very enjoyable when I found out that Nate was using my name like that. The biggest fights I've ever had with him, or anyone who's worked with me since, have been when I've caught them using their involvement with me to disrespect somebody else. Even if things don't happen the way that they're supposed to, there's a professional way to talk about it. It took Nate a long time to understand that. Yet, he did keep his word. He got me $2,500 for a weekend, double what I've been making, 2 months earlier than the deadline he set to make it happen. I have no idea what his dealings were or how it happened so quickly. All I know is that he was the angriest asshole with the best heart that I've ever met in my life. Chapter 73. Most of the moments when everything comes full circle, even though I'm continuing to move forward, which I think is geometrically impossible unless I just went around the world. Never mind. I think it's actually possible. Whenever I was back in L.A., I continued auditioning for small parts so that I could stay on screen in the faces of casting directors. I mean, eventually I landed a bit part in a movie called Meet Dave, which wouldn't be worth mentioning if not for the fact that the star of the movie was Eddie Murphy. I hung around the set every day hoping to meet the legend who started me down this path. But everyone guarded him like he was the president. Hey, don't go over there. Hey, he don't like to talk. When he comes over here, hey, just be ready to work. Months after the movie came out and bombed, I decided to ask Dave for Murphy's number and tried calling him, just to see if he'd speak to me. My heart was thudding through my shirt when he answered. I explained that he was a big reason why I was doing stand-up and that I was about to do my first hour-long special on a grown little man. My advice is don't ask for advice, he responded patiently. Trust yourself and your own way of doing things. Just because something worked for someone else doesn't mean it's going to work for you. It was good non-advice, which he has continued to give me over the years. With the blessing of the man responsible for the first comedy special I ever saw, I felt ready for my big show. I had a solid hour of material. I found a producer. Her name was Michelle Caputo. I rented the Skirball Center for Performing Arts in New York, and I'd given away all 800 tickets for free to make sure that the house was full. However, a week before the taping, Tori's mom called. I want to remind you that the credit card bill is due. That's what she said to me. I see you all had a good time this month. The bill, which was usually in the hundreds of dollars, was in the thousands, the maximum allowed on the card, and I didn't have enough money left in my account to pay it. It just so happens that the previous month, I discovered a loophole that allowed me to get an additional card for the account in Tori's name. I was pissed. I stormed into the bedroom. What you been doing with that goddamn credit card? It took every ounce of restraint that I had not to grab it and snap it in half. The only thing that was stopping me is that I knew that it would bend instead of breaking, and I end up struggling like an idiot to snap it. What do you care? You get to buy whatever you want for yourself. I never get anything. What are you talking about? You maxed out the card. Okay, how are you going to get to New York now? I still hadn't booked the plane tickets and hotel rooms for me, Tori and the kids, Nate and Naeem, who were opening the show. My bank account was nearly empty. The credit cards were done, and I had $35 in cash for food until then. Yo, we were fucked. I swallowed my pride and I called my opener act. Naeem. Hey, man. I need some money, dude. Wow. What for? It doesn't matter. I'm asking, so you know it's bad. All I got is like $300. I'm sorry, but can I borrow that? All right, yo, but just know you gotta have to give it back. I went to the bank, withdrew the rest of what I had, leaving 17 cents in the account just to keep them from closing it. I then went to a travel agency to buy tickets. I didn't have enough money to fly to New York, but the agent found a cheaper flight to Philadelphia that I'd be able to afford if I brought one fewer person. I asked her if she was cool with staying home. She flipped out. So I broke the news to Nate that I couldn't afford to bring him. I needed him there, but I needed the peace and quiet at this time more. Next, I had to figure out the rest. Hotel, transportation, food, an outfit for the show. I could ask Tori's parents to drive us from Philadelphia Airport to Manhattan and then to the show itself. But short of everyone sleeping in the car, I couldn't think of a legal way to take care of the rest of these things. I'd have to do it illegally. I called hotels in New York until I found one that accepted checks. Then I returned to the bank and asked for a set of checks for my account. Fortunately, they gave them to me without asking about my balance and the 17 cents. I had a college show the weekend after taping, and maybe I could get that payment into my account quickly enough to keep some of these checks from bouncing. Tori's parents met us at the airport. Her mom was so pissed that I couldn't afford to cover the American Express bill that she didn't speak to me the whole ride, except to say, I trusted you when you got that card, and I told you not to ruin my good credit. What's the matter with you? I said, I agree with you, and I apologize. I simply apologized to her, and I called American Express, and I said, I will work something out. She had every right to be upset. We pulled up to the hotel, poured out of the car, and walked up to the reception desk where I needed to deliver one of the best acting performances of my life. Whipping out my checkbook confidently. Hey, so who do I make this out to? You can just make it out to the hotel. And just a quick question. When is it clear? Just so I know for me just to get a little more clarity on how it works here. I'm not sure. Probably the next business day. Okay, good. That's great. And does the hotel have a happy hour at all with free snacks and drinks? No, I'm sorry. Not that matters. I'm just just a nice thing sometimes for my wife. She loves those. Come on, y'all. Let's get to the room. Hurry up. It was my worst performance since my Saturday Night Live audition. I'm sure she knew exactly what was going on. I didn't even have enough money to tip the valet. I wrote so many bad checks that weekend that if they could actually bounce, some would have cleared the football field. I just needed to make it to the Skirball Center the next night without getting arrested. I could figure out a way to dig myself out of all these holes afterwards. 20 hours later, Skirball Center. This was it. Lights, producers, cameras. My first big special was about to go down. I'm a grown little man. I checked to make sure the seats were filling up. Still too many empty ones. There was my family, though. Tori's family, Naeem's family, my fans that I knew by their first names. And then there was many I didn't. Okay, showtime. I walked out. The audience jumped to its feet applauding, screaming. Now, normally a good thing. Yeah, see, but we told them to do that for the special. This way, it'll look like that they paid to actually be there. I grabbed the microphone. The stand was too high. No one had adjusted it after Naeem's performance. If Nate were here, this wouldn't have happened. First joke, me trying to pick up a woman with baby seats in the back of my car. Big laughs. More jokes about my kids. Bigger laughs. I spotted Rick, Naeem's brother, in the audience. Couldn't look at him. He's too critical. Always tells me whether my delivery is good or bad. And where I perform the joke better. He's usually right. Damn, he caught my eye. He nodded and smiled approvingly, as if to say, "You're doing it, Kev. You got this." That was just what I needed to get in the zone and start demolishing. When the show ended, I brought Heaven and Hendrix on stage. Anyway, this is just so y'all can see that what I tell is the truth. I began to say that, and then I got choked up. A flood of joy and relief roared through me and lifted me up. I'd done it. I went to the theater lobby afterwards to thank everyone who came. I saw you at the Boston Comedy Club back in the day, man. That's what one woman said to me all excited. Then the guy nearby, "Boy, I remember you performing to 100 people at Caroline's. To know that there are individuals watching my career, invested in me, rooting for me, on a journey with me, that was the icing on the cake. The cake, of course, was the show itself. And the blown out candles on the cake were my bank account and credit. Back in Los Angeles, we stayed home for the rest of the week and ate everything on the shelves until it was time for my college show. I got paid for it with a check. So now I have a negative balance at the bank. I cashed the check elsewhere and began to rebuild my life. I brought food for the family and worked out a payment plan with American Express. It took a long time for Tori's mom to forgive me for dinging her credit, but American Express held its grudge even longer. Years later, when I was one of the highest paid comedians in the world and had a great credit rating, I applied for a card and was still denied. Comedy Central ended up buying I'm a Grown Little Man for $50,000, which after commission allowed me to pay off some of my expenses and debt. And though I was proud of the work, the special didn't explode into the world like we'd hoped. It came and went like everything else I'd done. I was just another comic with an hour-long special and a DVD and a CD to sell at my merchandise table. But I was fine with this outcome because by now, I'd come to accept that persistence is key. If I stayed persistent and on my grind, I would make it out of this hole and my dreams would come true. I just didn't know when. Life lessons from team building. I know I just said that you got to do things alone, but make sure you do things alone with the team. That may not seem like it makes sense now, but it makes total sense once you've read this section. And if it still doesn't make sense, then I suggest you get a team to help you understand it. Chapter 74. I'm thinking that I should get an honorary degree for all the college shows I've done. Call me if you can make this happen. Note, would prefer a doctorate. The thing that saved my ass, more than $50,000 from Comedy Central before I'm a Grown Little Man, was the NACAC. They called it NACA, the National Association for College Admission Counseling. Now, that may not sound like much, and it didn't to me either, but they organized an annual convention for 6,000 professionals from different high schools and colleges around the country. Nate and I set up a booth at the convention. After I performed a showcase there, people from different colleges stopped by our table to ask about hiring me. I took every show they offered. As a result of that convention, I ended up booking some 55 colleges that year, with each show paying between $700 and $2,500. Those shows gave me many opportunities to pay off more debts, to work on a new hour material, and to go practically to every state in the union and to make people laugh. Nate and I worked hard to get the contact information of everyone at each college show. Then we asked if anyone had connections at local comedy spots so we could come back and pick up an adult audience in the town as well. As we worked this system, however, club promoters began pulling me aside and telling me that they were going to stop booking me if they had to continue to deal with Nate. They complained about being threatened, distrusted, and micromanaged. They wanted to do business with someone else. I sat down with Nate in my hotel room one night. I said, listen, man, people are saying that they're not going to book me again if you're the one doing the business. So this is what I'm going to do. Because I like you and I'm loyal, I'm going to get us a personal appearance agent. Nate flipped out. No, man, hell no. Hell no, that's what I do. I'm the one to do that. Damn, man. Nate, listen to what I'm saying. We don't have a choice. No, ain't no way in hell you gonna let them white boys come in here and take over. I said, Nate, you're not listening to me. The clubs will not work with you. We have to slowly get you back into a position where they're comfortable dealing with you. Let me do what I gotta do, man. I don't know, Kev. He shook his head. He's like, I don't like it, man. I don't like it one bit. You don't need nobody else. The reason Nate had done so well for me up to this point was because he'd been as tenacious with the promoters and bookers as he was in this conversation. But I needed to make this change if I wanted to still have a touring career. It took me 4 more years to get that motherfucker to work civilly with people. The only other person in my life I argue with more than him is Tori. Dave Becky soon found me a new personal appearance agent, and his name was Mike Berkowitz. I told Berkowitz that I didn't want to do any more package shows, even if it meant turning down big money offers. He said, I can have you working as much as you want and by yourself. I said, good, because I want to work a lot, but not alone. I want to build my own team. Chapter 75. What Napoleon and I have in common, and it's not the height, because he had 2 inches on me. It's a true statement, people. I've had a lot of families in my life. I had the family I was born into, my mom, my dad, my brother. I had the family I married and fathered. That's Tori, Heaven, Hendrix. Then I had the family I work with, my fellow road warriors, most of whom are still warrioring with me today. Now, war is definitely the right metaphor for what we did. I mean, we attacked the country. Any town in the United States with a comedy club, we invaded. In the afternoons, we hit the streets, the barbershops, and the malls to find new recruits. In the evenings, we murdered and killed, and occasionally bombed. And at night, well, we conquered the bars, the clubs, and the night spots to find other kinds of recruits. Others is what we could call them. Combat turns men into brothers. And that's what the constant touring did to us. Like most brothers, we came to love each other, but we also fought. We learned to respect each other, but we also formed resentments and rivalries. Above everything, we are dedicated to the mission, to march up the long right-hand road to success. See, shortcuts may get you there quicker, but all the experience you gain on the long road allows you to stay there once you arrive. And everything that has happened in my life since then, my brothers have been there for me. Besides Nate, who's more like our creepy uncle, there are 4 more of them. It's time for you to get to know them a little better. Naeem Lynn, he's already been mentioned many times. You know that I met him on the Philly scene. He was my first road warrior, and he's been performing with me ever since. So nothing more really needs to be said. He's taking up enough space in my life. He doesn't need to be taking up any more space in my book. I'm done with you, Naeem. I think so. Or I may bring you up again later, so I don't know. But as of right now, I'm fucking done with you. Harry Ratchford, a.k.a. Bucket Low, like fuck it, dough. Harry was a friend that I met on Los Angeles comedy scene. He stopped performing soon after that, but we kept hanging out. He was loud, outgoing, and naturally funny. He made people around him smile and feel good. His marriage, like mine, was crumbling into open warfare, so whenever things got rough with Tori, I called Harry, and we drive the crazy horse in Las Vegas, where it was impossible to stay mad. Meanwhile, his wife and Tori became close friends. I have no idea what they did while we were gone. I mean, probably went to Thunder from Down Under somewhere. Who knows? Well, Harry was promoted at his graphic design job one day, and then fired the next for reasons that neither of us understood. I told him, I said, right now, I make $2,500 a weekend. I wouldn't mind giving you a piece of the pie if you wanted to write with me and help me build on the material I have. Just until you can figure things out. I never hired a writer or felt like I needed one, but I was willing to do anything to help a friend. It turned out, however, that I did need a writer, and Harry was more of a help to me than I expected. After each show, we'd run through the set together. That part where the girl you were on a date with tells you milk makes her shit, that was funny. But if you said me too afterwards, oh damn, wait a minute, hold on. No, that might be funny. Or not. Either way, I'll try it. Let's see what happens. Over time, Harry came to understand my voice as well as I did. As my set for the next hour-long special came together, I find that he had just one or two suggestions after the show, but each would make the material stronger. Harry never found another job, either because he believed in me or because he was unemployable. It's definitely one of the two. To this day, he's still my writer. He also keeps my ego in check. For free. He doesn't charge me for that. Example. Hey, man, I'm the shit. No, you're not. Sit down. That's called ego checking. Whatever. You guys don't understand it. Will Spank Horton. That's my other friend. Spank is his nickname. I don't want you guys to think like Will Spanked Horton. Like, that's not what I'm saying. It's Will. That's his first name, then Spank. It's his nickname, then Horton. When you say it together, it's like Will Spank Horton. Like, something nasty happened. It didn't. It's just a name. Let me tell you something about Spank. Spank has always thought that he was better than me. Ever since we met as kids, you know, he used to heckle me in the clubs when I was starting out. But now that I was making it, oh, now all of a sudden he wanted to get in on the act. Since he was sure that he was funny to me, I decided, hey, well, go ahead and just become a comedian. Yo, I've been doing this shit for a while, man. That's what Spank told me after Soul Plane came out. Now I'm starting to pop, baby. Hey, you gonna start fucking with me? Just watch. Next time I performed in Philadelphia, he did a guest spot. I'm not gonna lie, I was impressed. I was impressed by his charisma and his presence. Because he's so outgoing and vibrant, he can personality his way through a set and get big laughs, even though he neglects the craft. Afterward, Spank called and asked if I had any room for him in my next show. I said it's in Atlanta, but if you can get yourself there, then no problem. He got himself there. Turns out he had a college friend named Wayne who worked at Philadelphia International Airport. So he had a hookup for cheap flights. Before the show, Spank went to the green room, made himself a drink, met Nate, who greeted him with the usual charm. Don't be touching that, man. That's Kevin Hart's liquor. I don't know why Nate act like my name is on the fucking liquor bottles. That's Kevin Hart liquor! That's what he would yell at people. Randomly. Back at the hotel that night, I asked Spank what he wanted from comedy. He told me that he wanted a career. So I thought carefully about what I was getting myself into, you know, on account of the fact that he doesn't shower until someone complains about the smell. And I made him an offer. I'm not lying about Spank not showering. He's dirty. He's like a good dirty. He's not like the bad dirty where it's a real problem. Like, it's like, oh, God, I don't want that guy in my house. He's the dirty and just forgetting the shower on purpose. Yeah, that's a good way to explain it. I told Spank, I said, right now, it's just Naeem and me on stage. We wouldn't mind bringing you out with us. We could take over a whole night and make it our shit. But you got to find a way to get to these spots yourself. I don't really have the money right now to fly you like that. He says, no, dude, I figure it out. Just tell me what I got to do. Joey Wells, a.k.a. Old Ass, or Dub. Joey could die any day. He's the oldest. He's the oldest and closest to death. Joey was hosting a night at a place called the Comedy Union when I first arrived in L.A. Now, before I performed there, he soon became a part of the Madden games that Harry and I played at Rodney Perry's house. And we put in so many hours on that game, and sometimes Rodney's wife, man, she would cut the power off in the house just to get us to stop. Very smart move, by the way. Why argue with us when you can just simply cut the power off? I thought it was a brilliant move when she did it. She did it one time, and Rodney kept playing like ain't nothing happened. Clearly the lights are off, Rodney. The game isn't even on. He just kept pushing buttons on the joystick. True story. Joey had a streak of bad luck. A bunch of his gigs got canceled. His relationship fell apart. His car got towed. He didn't have enough money to pay his rent or even get his car back. It was a story that I could relate to. Well, not the car getting towed. My car's never been towed. That's a lie. That's a lie. Yeah, it has. Sorry. Sorry, I forgot that. Definitely forgot that. For months, that's a tough word for me, months. Because it should be pronounced months. Months. I say for months. Like, I almost say mots. For mots! But I can't say that because I would confuse you guys. So for months, Joy was walking and taking buses everywhere. But he was pretending like he still had a car. You know, he didn't want to ask for help. Not because he was too proud, but just because he was too nice. Joey's one of the most gentle, thoughtful guys you'll ever meet. Eventually, Harry and Rodney had a secret meeting with me about Joey. They explained the situation. They suggested I throw him some work. That night, we went to see Joey at the improv. And boom, 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 Joey slayed. Afterwards, I pulled him aside. Actually, I don't pull people aside. I got a loud mouth, which is a shocker. But I do. I've been told that I'm loud. So it's more like a public announcement. Trying to get an hour together, Joey. You want to do some fucking writing with us? I talked to Harry. Now, look, if something's going on, you can always tell me. Joey was like, nah, man, I'm all right. I kept insisting until finally he looked me in the eye and said, when do I start, man? I said, how's tomorrow? I could see the relief in his face. I didn't have extra money to pay him with, but I knew I'd find it somewhere. I later found out that he already had his bags packed and was about to return to his hometown to become a teacher. See, one of the problems with touring clubs is that sometimes the local hosts are terrible, and we have to perform to a dry crowd. So we solved that problem by bringing Joey along to MC the shows. And he's hosted with us ever since. Eventually, Joey got his car back. After, I'll say about a year, after a year that Joey joined, we came up with a name for this ragtag group of otherwise unemployable misfits. We were in Vegas complaining about our relationships and drinking tequila out of a bunch of red plastic cups. The ones that are always stacked next to the free alcohol at parties. You know what I'm talking about. I suggested that we all run away and move to Jamaica and just live together. As we toasted to that, Harry burst out, "We the plastic cup boys." The hell is that? That's what Spank said. Nigga, we always got plastic cups. So when you see these red cups, it's always a party or a good time. So we the plastic cup boys. I was tired of saying I was bringing my crew or my team or my package to each club. Now, I don't like saying package. So I ain't gonna talk about my dick. That sounds weird, but you get what I'm saying? Like I was, my team, my group, my pack, like they were the package. I'm not talking about my dick. Damn it. I said it. So now no matter what, that's what you guys are going to think it is. Nah, just leave it there. Fine. My dick. I should say my dick. Forget it. We needed a name, so from that day forward, we were the Plastic Cup Boys, and Nate had a new responsibility. Making sure we have red plastic cups everywhere we went. Chapter 76. I think that last chapter title was the only hype joke in this book so far, by the way. Wait. Is this my title? God damn it. I think it has to be. Yep. What I just said is going to be the title for chapter 76. And in some way, it's kind of genius. It was an amazing setup. Joey hosted, Spank opened, Naeem featured, and I closed. I wasn't touring as a comedian anymore, but as an entire traveling show. It worked for the clubs because they didn't have to do any more work to book the night. It worked for the audiences, who got a solid, consistent show. The downside was that traveling with a group this big was expensive. I mean, at first, look, we weren't making enough money to fly, feed, and lodge five people. But once we sold out a few clubs, Nate asked. So Nate pulled me to the side. Nate said, "Kev, I want to ask you something. Are you bold enough to try to do percentages at these comedy clubs? That's the question that I want to ask you." I said, "What do you mean?" He explained that he wanted to work out a deal with the clubs where instead of getting a flat rate for performing, we'd be paid a percentage of the money that the club made at the door each night. It was a risk because we make less on a bad show, but much more on a good show. Being a gambling man, I took the bet. See, the biggest challenge was making sure that the clubs didn't lie about the attendance. So every night, Nate would walk through the crowd with a mechanical counter. And on more than one occasion, I caught him checking the bathrooms just to make sure he hadn't missed anyone. At least that's what he told me he was doing in there. And I don't know. After every show, he'd be in the manager's office with his counter, calculator, number two pencil, and bill counting machine. He'd go over all the numbers, asking questions about every line item. Then he'd count the money three times just to make sure it was right. He'd be in there so long settling that a manager or promoter would pull me aside after the show and say, "Hey, you know, there are computer programs that you can do all of this stuff that he's doing." Almost half the time, though, Nate would discover that the numbers were off in the house's favor. So he'd ask for what was right. If that didn't work, he'd yell for what was right. If that didn't work, he threatened for what was right. And once, when that didn't work and the promoter started pushing him, Nate stabbed him with his pencil. True story. We never played that club again, by the way. See, as we toured more, we put together a system that enabled me to walk away with $3,500 a weekend. Adding another $1,500 a week in merchandise, and we were making $20,000 a month. Then came Wayne. God damn it,